Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Homer, Alaska author Daniel Coyle. We'll be discussing his book, The Talent Code, which is describing his search to understand why some talent appears to be learned and how brain research is helping develop a better understanding of how all of us can learn better and faster, regardless of age. To reach us today about any questions or comments you have in Anchorage, we have a number 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, you can email us during the next hour at lineone, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. Dan, it's a real pleasure to have another person with some Anchorage roots. Last week we interviewed a psychologist now at the University of Louisiana and about some psychological myths, and I happen to know you grew up in the Anchorage area. And actually, I said you're from Homer author, but you're joining us from Ohio, where you split the time now, I understand.
That's right. We're going back and forth between the Midwest and the Great North, so half time each place.
Well, tell us a little bit about your early life, in particular about how you got into writing. It's always interesting to me, and then we'll try to work our way towards the book and some of the more medical aspects of all of this.
Yeah, you bet, Dad. It's nice to be here. I grew up in Anchorage. We moved there when I was three. My dad was in the public health service, and it's kind of interesting growing up outside of America a little bit. I think there's a fair number of writers who come from Alaska, and I don't know exactly. It could be the water. It could be the light. But I think it's got something for me anyway. It's got something to do with kind of two things, the real sense of possibility you get growing up there. You don't sort of get told what you have to do, or there's no real boundary set on what you might become. And that kind of that perspective you get when you're looking at something from the outside. I mean, you get a chance to write a story. You don't necessarily want to be the guy in the story. You want to be the guy who's living a little bit further away, who sees it in perspective. And Alaska definitely gives you that, where you don't kind of buy into things so quickly as you learn to watch them closely. And that was a kind of an advantage, I think, that I'm realizing now that I had all along due to Alaska.
One other comment about writing that I'd like to just ask is, this is your, I'm aware of four books and that you've published. One is Hardball, A Season in the Projects, which I have read, and two that I haven't, Walking Samuel and Lance Armstrong's War, and now this one, The Talent Code. Is there a thread to these in some way that you can share with us, or are they just kind of things you got interested in?
Yeah, I guess, they sort of felt, originally they sort of felt like that. One is through sports, one's a sort of a novel, one's a portrait of Armstrong, one is, this other book is a little bit more of a, scientific explanation of why people get good at stuff. When I look deeper at it, though, I think there is a strong thread, and it's, all of these are sort of x-rays. Maybe it's because my dad was a radiologist that... Maybe I'll attribute it to that. But this idea that, we go through the world and we see interesting things and we see great performances, we see great talent, we see great characters, great achievements, and it's always fascinated me. Maybe growing up competitive with two brothers, wanting to know what's beneath that. What makes up a guy like Lance Armstrong, or why does somebody become really, really, really good? Over the course of writing for a lot of different magazines, those were the questions that I kept returning to, and especially when I had kids of my own, this idea of why we become who we become, what forces shape us. I don't believe that destiny is unchanging. It seems like there are things that really profoundly change our destiny, and I'm really interested in seeing how those interact with us in different spaces, whether it's the space of sports or art or math or music or anything.
So can you recall, I know how the talent code gets started in discussion about a young girl playing the clarinet, but is that where the spark and the idea started that developed into a book, or was there something before that even?
Well, you got to be really wary of origin stories. Anybody who tells you, "Yeah, my book began on this moment," is not telling you the truth. I think these, you know, like any book, these things happen in little bits, little puzzle pieces that sort of get put out there, and then at some point click together in different shapes. And I guess for me, a couple of the clicks were, number one, when I saw a newspaper clipping about a tennis club outside of Moscow called Spartak, and that club had, you know, according to the clip, had produced more top 20 women players than the entire United States, which sort of floored me. You know, a single club, and it happened to have one indoor court, produced that many great players. That blew me away. So that was one. And then I actually called a filmmaker who had visited it, and he said, "Oh, you know, you got to go to this place. It's a total dump. You know, you won't believe it. It's just, you know, broken glass and stray dogs. It's not like any tennis club you've ever seen." And that really, really got me interested. And then the other sort of puzzle piece was, as a former, you know, I studied pre-med in college for a long time and nearly became a doctor. You know, I took the MCATs and was really interested in that stuff before I sort of changed course. And so I was reading a lot about the science of talent, of performance, what great performance is made of, what changes happen in the brain when you practice in certain ways. And so plugging those two things together was really the moment when the book came together for me, the idea that this place and these other places, because Spartak, this Moscow tennis club, is not the only one that we know of where, you know, a lot of great performers come from small places. It's a pattern that happens in sports, it happens in art, it happens in math and music. And the idea that I could go and look at these places and then see how they connected to the science, that you could sort of take an X-ray of excellence. And that was where the book really, I said, okay, this is something bigger than just a magazine article. Maybe this is something something that could turn into a book.
Mm-hmm. How many years of research did it take to gather all the information?
It was a long process because I ended up visiting 9 hotbeds around the world, traveling about 50,000 miles, and it took about a year and a quarter to do that, and then it took about another year to write the book. It took a long time to figure out exactly how to tell this story, but yeah, 2 years from sort of top to bottom.
Clarinet player that I mentioned is this kind of the beginning of the book, a fictional named Clarissa, who was an Australian teen that was, I guess there's a video. I never could get my hands on the video, although I looked around to see how this worked. You want to take us through a little bit of that picture as well?
Yeah, it's sort of the first person we meet in the book. And Clarissa was part of this study, and it was a great study because it basically tracked a whole bunch of music students, and it tried to figure everything out about them so that it could figure out why they were progressing or not progressing. You know, and so as a part of this study, they were videotaping every day of practice. And you're watching this videotape with the guy who did the study, this Australian music psychologist named Gary McPherson. And she, in the course of one practice, and it's about a 10-minute-long practice, for the first 5 minutes she practices kind of normally. She's playing a song that she's played a bunch, and she plays it right through, and she doesn't really stop. She makes mistakes, and she just sort of keeps going. And then for the second 5 minutes of the practice, she changes. She practices in a completely different way. It's a different song, and she's learning it. And she learns it very differently. She pays deep attention to the mistakes. She'll play a short part of the phrase, and when she makes a mistake, she stops. It's like the clarinet becomes electrified. And then she goes back to the beginning and she hums it. And then she goes back and she just does the fingering and doesn't actually play the tune. And then she plays it and she gets a little further and she stops. It sounds like hell. It actually sounds terrible, you know, because it's very fitful, it's very broken. But according to Dr. McPherson, during those 5 minutes, she's accomplishing a month's worth of practice. Her learning velocity, the speed with which she is teaching herself this song, increases 10 times in this brief amount of time. And so watching it with him is fascinating because he's looking at it and saying, look, during that first 5 minutes when she was practicing shallowly, she's wasting her time. She should go outside and play in the yard. But during the second 5 minutes, if she could do that every time, she would increase her learning tremendously. She's actually, during that time, sort of constructing her brain. And so that very idea was very almost magical to me, because we think about practice, you know, we connote it with drudge work. We connote it with sort of a virtuous obligation. But what was showing in that videotape and what Clarissa shows is that in the right kind of practice, there is this kind of magic, this sort of transformative moment when you can really learn incredibly quickly and change your brain.
I guess that's kind of different in a sense. This deep practice is the term you use, but it's as you describe it here, it reminds me of being in the zone, which you hear psychologists and sports psychologists and athletes talk about at times. Being in the zone is where you're just letting things happen without thinking about it, but is there, in your mind, a similarity there, or not really? This is different stuff.
They're different zones. I mean, they're different zones. Usually when you talk about the zone, we can talk about, Csikszentmihalyi's work, where he's talking about kind of a moment of complete relaxation and performance. And this isn't about performance. This is about constructing something. This is about building your brain. It's not about producing a talent, a beautiful endpoint. But I guess the real insight that I got through the neurologist that I spoke with is you really have to think of talent as an electrical circuit. You know, we talk about muscle memory, but the truth is that muscles don't actually have any memory at all.
Right.
All of the intelligence is in the circuit of your brain. And in building a circuit that does the right thing at the right time, this fast, fluid, beautiful broadband, and that's what talent is. You know, that's what a Jimi Hendrix guitar solo is, or that's what an Einstein equation is. It's this beautiful electrical circuit. And so the deep practice is really the act of carpentry, the act of construction that is difficult and sort of slow and a little messy, where you're making these mistakes and you're repeating intensely when you find the right pattern, and you're very attentive to your mistakes, and you've got this, you know, the expression that I saw when I went to these places, when people were in this state, was sort of the face of Clint Eastwood, you know. They're absolutely focused. It's a little painful, but they're pushing themselves. They're operating on the edges of their ability, and that edge is where progress really happens.
And it sounds like that mistakes are an asset, and mistakes are an opportunity to learn. They're not something to be to give you a bad sense, a bad feeling, or anything. They're that opportunity to move to the next layer.
But we look on them as judgment, and it's easy to do that. You know, we look on mistakes as kind of a verdict, like, I don't have it. I just don't have that ability. But what you see in top performers is an eagerness to sort of targeted efforts that create certain mistakes, and they pay deep attention to those mistakes. There's this guy named Bill Roberty, who's a world champion in a bunch of different things. He's a very good chess player. He's a world champion in poker and backgammon. And his system is to, whenever he finishes playing a game, he goes back and he reviews the tape of that game. He focuses intensely on every little mistake that he makes, win or lose the game. And you see that same pattern in good ball players. You see it in good performers of all kinds, because, like you say, a mistake really is an opportunity. It's a leverage point. And if you look at it, you know, talent is like building, you're trying to build this circuit, and a mistake shows you where to build it. A mistake shows you where to go. And so to be in a position where you're constantly on the edge of your ability, making those mistakes and figuring out where to go, is to be on the position of, look, you're building the circuit, you're building the map, and mistakes are the leverage points that you use to figure out where to go.
Let me take just a second to remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest is Dan Coyle. He's an author who's written a book called The Talent Code, which kind of looks at talent a little differently. Not that it's something we're all born with, but that can be learned. And we're getting ready to get into the neurology, the neurophysiology, the neurobiology of this a little bit, because it's fascinating to me. But if you have questions or comments, please don't hesitate to call us, 550-8433, 550-8433 is the local number. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@kska.org. Dan, I want to get to the biology, and then we can kind of flesh out some more of the basics of how this idea of talent being learned can occur. But it's kind of like a definition, and we now are beginning to understand the correlates of how we learn anything is going on in the brain. You want to take just a second, see if you can paint us a picture of what's going on in our noggins?
Well, one big thing is to start kind of from the way outside and say, okay, what do great performers have in common? You know, what do they have in common? What if you took all the best of every possible, you know, profession or sport or art and put them all in one room? You know, all the best conductors, all the best guitar players, all the best basketball players, all the best doctors. And they wouldn't have anything in common except for one thing. They wouldn't have any. They wouldn't have genes in common. They wouldn't have culture in common. They wouldn't be the same sex or height or weight or anything. But the one thing they would have in common would be that they would have spent approximately 10,000 hours in intensive practice. That's the thing that gets you in that club. Now, does that mean everybody can get in that club? Absolutely not. But because that's the one thing, I think that shows us that it helps underline the point that practice is not just kind of a dutiful obligation, but kind of an opportunity, a place where real magic sort of happens. And as we zoom into that, you know, when you pay attention to errors, when you repeat intensively, when you're in a state of intensive practice, what's happening is you're building pathways in your brain. And as a part of that, it's really fascinating that it ended up being kind of a core of my interest, and it's a substance called myelin, M-Y-E-L-I-N. And myelin, as we've kind of learned in biology class, a lot of us, it's the wrapping of the electrical circuit of the brain. It wraps the axons and, that connect the different neurons. It's basically like electrical tape that goes over the sort of raw copper of your connections. And like any electrical tape, it keeps the voltage in. It keeps the voltage from leaking out, and it makes that voltage move, that electrical impulse move a lot more quickly. But the big discovery of the last 15 years has been that myelin, that electrical tape, reacts when we practice intensively. When we practice intensively, we actually are growing electrical tape around our wires. There's been some great studies of piano players and of children learning to read, where hours of practice will grow myelin in your brain. And the myelin growth is proportional to the hours of practice. So what it's saying is if you practice 100 hours, you get a certain amount. If you practice 200 hours, you get double that. So each hour is earning you more wraps of this electrical tape. And when that electrical tape gets really thick, you end up getting sort of like a superhighway, like a broadband effect, where you can carry thousands of times more information down these wires, and they can reload and fire over and over again. And you can build sort of this fast, fluent, beautiful electrical circuit that, you know, your brain doesn't care what it uses its circuits for. Those circuits could be used for algebra or French or whatever you decide to spend time working on. But that is, that's what's going on. And so the act of practicing, the act of paying attention to mistakes, figuring out where exactly you want those junctures to be in your circuit, and intensively repeating, growing broadband, growing that electrical tape, builds speed and fluency and accuracy, and shows us why that 10,000 hours, that's what's happening during those 10,000 hours, is they're actually constructing these beautiful skills.
And I guess it's almost inherent. If we're going to do something 10,000 hours, it makes sense to kind of start a little bit early. And then there's this physiologic correlating in this. That's when the myelin is laid down the most efficiently. And actually, there's a time sequence kind of, because we know the brain is developing continually early through adolescence and even adulthood. That's somehow related to myelin.
That's right. Myelin arrives naturally in a wave from the back of the brain to the front. So it does the motor areas first, so babies can crawl and move and feed themselves, and then it moves forward as you age. And that myelin sort of arriving in a wave means that if you practice during that key time on those areas, when it's arriving in that area, you can get really, really good because you're growing, you're earning more electrical tape with each impulse, with each practice. We all know that if you start speaking a language, a young language, before the age of 12, there's kind of this golden window where you can get quite good. And if you wait until after that window closes, it's not impossible. It's far from impossible, but it's a little bit more difficult. And so that's why you constantly have this pattern when it comes to top performers, that most of them start fairly young. You do not have people in the NBA who started playing basketball when they were 18. You do not have people in symphonies who pick up violins when they're 12. They start young because that is aligned with the way we build our brains the fastest and the best.
We have a.
But that said, people often will take that information and they'll think, well, I should, there's no sense me starting because it's obviously too late, or I shouldn't let my child start. And to that, I think, it's easy to sort of have that reflexive thought, but in the long run, the process doesn't really change. If you do want to get good at that, we all kind of walk the same path. And the truth is, most of us aren't going to be world class. Most of us just want to get a little better at the things that we do. And that essential path, that certain kinds of practice make our brains better, that never changes, regardless of if you're in the golden window or if you're not.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller. I want to take Carolyn's call. Carolyn, what can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to thank you for this program. I think it's very, very interesting. I'd heard about the book where they talked about the 10,000 hours, and of course, you have to have the leisure of not having to work in the fields in order to have that kind of time. So it's certainly something that would benefit our Western culture and economic interests. But my a couple of questions. Number one, does this not show the importance for us to have good universal education for all of the kids in this country? Because obviously we can afford to educate all of our children at a much higher level than if they were in some third world country. And then secondarily, I recently heard about some research where they tell parents of so-called gifted children that they're much better off praising their tenacity or their diligence or whatever you want to call it in their efforts, because if you tell a bright child that they're bright and you keep telling them this, that when they first run up against something they don't know how to do, they're very likely to
very
back
likely
off completely.
To back off completely.
Yeah. Very good points.
Very good.
Thank you.
Dan, you still with us?
Yeah, I am.
That's fascinating, Carolyn, yeah.
We're certainly get some echo. So her point was starting early with education is important, and then maybe we should be rewarding effort rather than outcomes as much.
That's very true. I couldn't agree more on the first point. On the second point, it's fascinating. There's a couple of great studies that it sounds like Carolyn is tuned into, where really when you tell a kid, oh, you're so smart, they will actually act to protect that status, and then they will take fewer risks. And when you tell a kid, hey, good job, you tried hard, those kids will be willing to take on much more risk. They'll be able to take on much harder tasks, and they will enjoy those hard tasks more, whereas the first group will find them unpleasant. So what's interesting about that to me is that really when you tell a kid that he's a genius, you're not really telling them the truth. You know, they might perform well, but the truth is that, you know, everybody, there's no such thing as a natural born genius. I heard a great quote the other day. I mean, there's certainly people that are quite good. There are occasional incredible performers who are, savants in certain areas. But for the great majority of us, to call someone gifted or a genius isn't necessarily the best thing to do, because it's much more honest and much more truthful to praise the work they put into something rather than to sort of give them a verdict and absolutely define them as being different from everyone else. And it's clear also when you see the lifelong performance of prodigies that the vast majority of prodigies do not end up becoming great adult performers. And part of that, I think, is partly because of the sort of pressure that gets put on people who tend to perform well.
Carolyn's suggestion about educating and educating early was one of the issues I wanted to get into it. As we understand this neurobiology, is that when we do something, we learn it. For example, riding a bike. And once you learn how to ride that bike, really, you're never going to unlearn it. It's not actually possible. You may need a little practice, but it comes back. So that when we learn things and learn them well, they're there forever. But if we learn them wrong, or we squander that opportunity early in life, then it's we're behind the eight ball from then on. And if that is true, which I think is what what you're saying and what I'm reading, then it's really imperative very early in life to stimulate kids in an appropriate way. And I guess that's even at some of the basis of the whole Head Start program in the United States. Do you care to comment on this from an educational standpoint is where I'm going, Dan?
Yeah, I don't know much about Head Start in particular, but it's clear from the research, and I see it even in the families of the neurologists that I visited. How do they raise their children? What decisions are they making? It's extraordinarily clear that young brains are incredibly busy, and that a lot of big decisions are being made in their first experiences with education. There's a great book called The Scientist in the Crib by Allison Gopnik that goes some distance to show exactly how deeply little children are paying attention and making big decisions about their identity, about whether they're a learner, about what their ambitions are at incredibly young ages. And this is all happening. And so to provide an environment that is aligned with that, it's a great use of resources in terms of finding a way to build a place that is aligned with the way brains actually learn, a place that helps repetition happen, a place that helps kids fall in love with things, a place that has a little bit of passion built into it. So it gives hopefully this new science, that I write about in the book sort of gives people some X-ray goggles they can use to look at their own schools and at their own kids to see, okay, what are we doing here that is aligned with the way people actually learn, and what are we doing here that is not aligned with the way people actually learn? For instance, giving grades to very young kids and giving them tests and test scores. You know, a lot of people do that. A lot of places do that. And there's a lot of science out there that shows that that's completely worthless and even harmful. And I know that I grew up in college-gate school at a time where it was sort of a hippie time in college-gate school, and there were no grades. I don't know if that's still true, but I think that helped, at least in my own case, of sustaining that sense of possibility and creating those kind of moments of passion that help create lifelong learners.
I think what I'd like to do now is I'm going to go ahead and take a break, and then I'm going to come back and also maybe introduce another individual that I discovered through this program that has some similar ideas. I'm not sure you're aware of him or not, but I think it's an opportunity to stretch ourselves a little bit. So I want to remind our listeners, once again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm interviewing Dan Coyle about his book, The Talent Code, discussing how talent can be learned. We're on Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guest is Homer author Daniel Coyle, and we're talking about his book, The Talent Code. It describes his search to learn more about where talent truly comes from and what brain research is revealing about learning. You can email your questions to us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening to Line 1 tonight, but 7 to 8, you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast and won't be able to take your phone calls or emails at that time. Dan, a number of years ago, I interviewed an individual by the name of Jim Thompson. And he was the founder of an organization called the Positive Coaching Alliance, which has a lot of professional athletes really involved in it. And their goal was to promote excellence in all life skills, really through sports, using some evidence-based principles, which are similar to what you're talking about. He got into the idea that winning was not the idea. You wanted to redefine winning as effort, as our previous caller, Carolyn, had talked about, that we want to make kids really want to work harder and harder and really fall in love with the game, which would then, in a sense, stimulate them to practice and practice through positive reinforcement and kind of honoring the game. His website is www.positivecoach.org. It's still in existence, and it's really a spreading philosophy, I think, even through sports psychology, to really focus. And it seems to me it's very much like what you're saying. It's changing the way we think about sports to encourage more and more practice, which is where you're at and where the physiologic correlates fit.
That's exactly right. I think what, you know, I'm sort of distantly familiar with the Positive Coaching Alliance, and I think what they're reacting to is the fact that, okay, here's the United States with the most population, the most money, the most energy being poured into youth sports, and yet when you go on the international level, we're getting beaten by Serbia, by Brazil in soccer, we're getting beaten in hockey, we're getting beaten in baseball, in the International Baseball Classic, by Korea, a country that is about 1/100th of our size, or 7/100ths of our size. So, you know, you really have this effect where being rich and having great facilities and really caring a lot doesn't do it. What does do it, and when you look in places like the hotbeds that I visited, is these places that absolutely are obsessed with great practice. And that doesn't have much to do with the scoreboard. You know, in this country, we tend to be about winning at every level. And in other countries, what you see is that they've found ways, either by leaving the game still to the kids, in terms of leaving it still a pickup game, or by finding ways of redefining winning to make it about good practice. I saw that firsthand at Spartak, at the tennis club that we talked about at the top of the show, where they really make having a great forehand, having great form, to be the coolest thing that a kid can have. They absolutely celebrate it, and when a kid gets it, that becomes a big moment. They actually don't compete for several years in terms of conventional tournaments and conventional matches. Instead, they compete in their own way, which is who's got the most beautiful backhand. And the kid that has that is the one that culture celebrates. So it's fascinating to see those principles that really are coming from the ground up in these sort of rough corners of the world where the kids are learning sport at an incredibly high rate, an incredibly high level, and bringing them back to this country and applying them with some success. Because it really is about having the kid fall in love so that they will think about it all the time, that they're absolutely passionate about their practice and obsessed with getting to the next skill level, not to the next victory level, not to winning on the scoreboard, but to becoming a little bit better at the skill. And that, you know, of course, doesn't apply only to sport. It applies to everything.
Mm-hmm. Your book is divided into three big principal sections: deep practice, ignition, and master coaching, which is, I guess, ways to... that you've broken down how these different places you visited, you're thinking, you're talking with scientists, it really encourages the development of talent. These three segments are necessary: deep practice, ignition, and good master coaching. You want to talk about these a little bit too?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, if you break it down, you know, if we can kind of take an x-ray of this process, you know, the practice is the act of construction. If the final skill is this sort of beautiful, fast, fluent electrical circuit that can be used for anything, you can use it to play piano or hit a baseball or run a radio show, that's the end goal. So to get there, you got to have the practice. You got to actually spend the time building this thing, you know, with the dump trucks and the bulldozers and the shovels, building this thing. That's the practice portion of it. That's the 10,000 hours. The second question, though, the second element is, hey, it takes a lot of energy to do that. You know, that is a massive act of construction. I remember talking to one neurologist about, we were talking about tennis, and I said, how many neurons are in a tennis swing? And he said, probably 500,000. So building that beautiful 500,000 neurons takes an incredible amount of energy. It takes an incredible amount of passion and irrational energy. You know, the practice part is very logical. It's very cool and almost scientific because you're building this thing. But it takes an irrational, passionate, weird amount of energy, obsessive energy usually, to fuel that process. It's not normal to want to spend 10,000 hours getting really good at anything. And so that ignition part is really the types of signals that come in from our environment, the lightning bolts, really, that happen. Somebody says, look, this is who I am. This is what I want to do. This is who I am, what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Those moments are sort of what ignition is all about, these ideas that kids, frequently kids, but sometimes adults, get when everything sort of changes and they fall in love with the idea, some future vision of themselves. That's the ignition portion of this. And so there's this sort of yin-yang paradox where you have this constructive process that's fueled by these real lightning bolts, these moments where kids look down and say, no, that's me. And the third part of this master coaching is the people, the sort of rare people I found, and I found them at each of the talent hotbeds that I visited, who are really equipped to fuel this process. On each side, they're equipped to help give kids passion, and they're equipped to tell kids how to practice and teach them what to do at any given moment. You know, they tend to be older people. They tend to have great sense of humor. They tend to be really, really excellent communicators. And so these rare people that you find at each of these places are the ones who, I don't know, they're kind of the living embodiment of the process because they know what to do, but they also can inspire the energy to do it. And these are those three things. I mean, it's not as, you know, this isn't like making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It's this complicated process that is not very controllable, really, because the passion is a very uncontrollable element of it. But that's the pattern that we see in each of these cases. You need all three of these to really have a talent hotbed.
I want to come back to that some more. We do have a caller, and I want to take Janan. Is it Janan?
Yeah, that's right.
What can we do for you?
Well, you know, I was going to comment on something earlier, but I've been sitting and listening now, and I actually want to just briefly tell you in reference to the speaker's last dialogue about what it takes for the talent hotbeds. I think that each family can do this themselves. I raised three sons. I'm a retired teacher, and they each were totally passionate about at least one thing, usually didn't have anything to do with academics, right? And in most cases, outside of school, karate, chess, music. And they did exactly what you're describing with mentors that happened to be in our community, leading, you know, a chess club or leading the band. And none of them are doing those things now as young professionals. But everything they learned through that passion for chess in one case, where he thought about it constantly every day, sometimes to the detriment of his academic program, he's now, you know, an attorney with the job of his dreams that he just got a few months ago. Mm-hmm. So he transferred all that energy and the passion for chess into the field of law and did it with the same kind of abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I encourage parents not to have to think that they have to find a talent hotbed, but to do it themselves by encouraging their kids in whatever they're excited about.
That's
and
a great
let them
point.
Do it 100%.
Yeah, I've often, from my own kids, begin to talk to families in my office. I'll often ask them what is your child's affinity? What is it that they seem to want to do innately to try to build on? And I'm not sure if that necessarily fits in this, but it kind of kids are different, and really from the get-go, you'll see someone who really, really likes trucks or guns or dancing or music. I mean, very, very early you see some things that I think are important for us to realize for the rest of our lives. And at least what I hear Janan saying is that's an opportunity to build on that natural interest in someone.
And they will build those neurons no matter what they're doing. If they're doing it passionately, they're going to build the neurons.
Okay.
And they may not stick with that particular thing, but their brain patterns are going to be there for learning.
I got you. Okay.
No, I like that. I like the word you use, abandonment. I think that's an important word here, because it's something, when you get an education, people sort of like things to be cool and logical and controlled. And in fact, when you look at top performers, it's all about abandoning yourself to this passion. There's a great researcher named Carol Dweck who says, you know, being a parent these days is pretty hard, right? I mean, there's a lot of sort of anxiety and pressure. And what Carol Dweck says, which I take a lot of, I think it's very wise, she says, all parenting can be boiled down into two things. You should pay attention to what your child stares at. That's number one. Pay attention to what your child stares at. To stare at something is really an important act. It's an important moment. And the second thing is to praise them for their effort. Those two things. And I think your point that really parents are in charge, you know, shouldn't go shopping for talent op-eds, but should, you know, work on growing a garden at home first, I think that's really an essential point. I think you're dead right.
Well, and the other thing is not to despair if the child is doing something in a field that you don't understand or don't think deserves that much attention. So my husband would despair because our son would spend so much time playing chess and thinking about chess that he wondered whether he was going to graduate high school. And now he just finished a master's in tax law, and I kept telling him someday he'll be interested in something that'll, you know, help support him. Don't worry. And it turns out to be true. So,
well, wives are always right in those debates, aren't they? I mean, I've found that to be true, but no, you're definitely right. And what's more like chess than law? I mean, you're right to say these skills do transfer. The world is a very big place, and passion is the thing you don't find very much.
Thanks for your call, Janine.
Okay.
You know, it reminds me of the mother who came to the pediatrician and said, my child's obsessed with guns. I think he's going to be a serial killer. And the advice from the pediatrician was, yeah, but maybe he's going to be a nuclear disarmament specialist, you know.
Oh.
So we don't know where these things are going to take us. And so that's what I think Janine's saying, is encourage that stuff. And what the science and what we're talking about is all about. Chunking is a part of your practice that we've talked about a little bit. I'd love to hear you talk some more about what the term chunking means and how it has to relate to learning and deep practice.
Well, it's funny. It's such a dumb-sounding word, isn't it? Chunking sounds like something from the Flintstones. But in fact, you know, for people who study this stuff professionally, it's sort of the most important word, because it refers to the act of taking any complicated skill and breaking it down into its Legos, you know, into its essential building blocks. And why is that so effective? I mean, right now we're having a conversation using just a handful of sounds and 26 letters in the alphabet, and we've constructed this amazing thing out of a pretty simple alphabet. And chunking is exactly the same thing. It takes all the essential things, all the essential bits of, say, a movement or a sound or an idea. By breaking them down into your elements, you are actually sort of replicating, you're able to learn them much better when you slow something down and you're able to break it down into its chunks and then rebuild it. Because each chunk can become part of a larger chunk. You can combine a set of chunks into a bigger chunk and then those chunks into a bigger chunk. And you end up with sort of this combinatorial power, just as you do with the alphabet. You take words, you take letters and combine them into words, and you take words and combine them into sentences, and you take sentences and combine them into paragraphs, take paragraphs and combine them into even bigger things. And so if great skill is sort of, you know, these beautiful novels or books, think of chunking as that act of creating the smallest bits that has the greatest power. So it's kind of counterintuitive. When you look at really good performers, if you look at Peyton Manning's pregame routine, what it is, it's this really, really basic stuff. He does this very, very simple footwork drill and very, very simple release drill. And you'll see the same thing among top musicians, where they warm up by simply playing one note after another very slowly. This simple power of doing one thing exactly right is kind of what chunking is all about, because those simple perfections add up into larger perfections.
And to me also, I'm hearing that it's learning the fundamentals And then you can build on easier. But even more important than that, it's what are the building blocks of the fundamentals that you get exactly right. And then you're in, through good coaching and ignition and practice, you really, that's how you get successful at something.
Well, it's true, and especially with certain skills where those fundamentals really matter. You know, if you look at learning how to play the violin, you know, for example, there's only one way to play an A minor chord. You know, there's not 50 ways to do it. And so to make those early pathways accurate, a neurologist, to me, describes those early repetitions as like pushing a sled down a snowy hill. Your sled will tend to go in those tracks the next times. So the first time you play that chord, the first time you hold that violin is a really, really important moment. And you see that, actually, when if you look at the way the sort of famous Suzuki method of violin instruction, which is this incredibly successful way of teaching young people how to play all types of instruments, really puts a tremendous amount of focus on those first repetitions because they are so important. They'll practice doing nothing but just holding the violin for several lessons before they even are allowed to hold the bow.
It sounds like what I was what you were describing in the Spartak experience there in Russia with the tennis players as well.
Yeah, exactly. Those first paths, I mean, you can save yourself a lot of work. Because if you do it right the first time, if you build it correctly, you don't have to go unbuild it or rebuild it. And I was out at the U.S. Olympic Training Center a couple of months ago, and one of the coaches made the point that he felt like most of what they did was they had to unteach people how to do things. They weren't teaching habits. They were trying to fix bad habits.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you are doing those first repetitions, really paying a lot of attention to them is absolutely the thing to do.
I want to ask you to comment on something that I am certainly not qualified to comment on, and you're probably going to say you're not either, but I want to take this idea of how we learn habits and extrapolate that a little bit into some important things in medicine, and that's treatment of anxiety, depression, people having negative thinking about certain situations. It seems to me that you could use the model that that's what's happening in those individuals from either a genetic standpoint or whatever, they've begun to have these repeated circuits of anxiety or depression or negative thinking, which are no different than learning different skills, and that perhaps, and again, I'm not saying this is by any means makes sense, I'm just asking your opinion, we could adapt this idea to therapy, perhaps, of teaching them how to ride the bike differently again.
Right. Well, I guess the place I saw that most vividly, I visited a place called the Shyness Clinic. It's in Palo Alto. It's in Silicon Valley. And it is a place where people who have got serious, serious social issues go. People who have been on the Internet for years have never talked to a human being in the last 6 months. And they go to get straightened out. And the way they get straightened out, actually, is not that different from the way they teach the forehand at Spartak. It's fascinating because they go to their group session and the therapist doesn't care about their past. The therapist doesn't ask them about their parents. What they do is a series of drills, and they try to and each drill is meant to make you stretch a little farther. You know, and you probably make some mistakes and it feels strange, but they want to get them in that zone at the edge of their ability, and they have them do things like go ask 10 people what time it is. Or go talk to a stranger, or go call up an old friend. And each day is a little more, to the point where they'll have them do things like walk into a grocery store, lift up a watermelon, and drop it on the floor. You know, do these kind of crazy things that really put a lot, or are very unshy. And they teach them to endure this area on the edge of their discomfort and to manage these emotions, you know, which is, as you say, a circuit. Mm-hmm. To manage that emotion, to endure it, to feel it, and to build a circuitry around it that enables them to survive those feelings. And so it's not quite the same, of course, as learning a forehand, but the process of kind of getting on the edge of your ability and repeating that experience to the point that you become kind of used to it. And they've had a similar success treating post-traumatic stress syndrome in veterans, where they teach them to endure and manage these triggers that normally would set off this uncontrollable physical fear response or anxiety response, and have them immerse themselves in those worlds that they once feared so much. And it's kind of, they've had quite a lot of success with this. And it's interesting. I mean, you know, if you start thinking of, you know, emotions as a skill, you know, it's it sort of frees you up to have a little more control over them than if you think of them as something that's inevitable or you're born that way. There was a guy I met in the Shyness Clinic who had not been able to speak to women for months, if not years. And the day I met him, he was going to a ballroom dancing class. Just almost a complete transformation of his social circuitry, you could say.
Now, a correlation of this, or a correlate to this, it just dawns on me, is that those old circuits are still there. And it's a little bit like an addiction to alcohol or cocaine or something. That reinforcement is there. We're learning a different way around it. And so it's always, there's some risk of falling back into older habits. Is that anything you've run into or makes sense to you?
No, that absolutely does. That does make a lot of sense. And certainly when you're dealing with things that, you know, involve chemical dependencies, it's very difficult to, it's very strange to kind of liken it to improving your golf swing. You know, it's a fundamentally a different area, as you pointed out at the top of this. But those sled tracks are still there. I have to say, that was one of the things that, you know, gets pointed out about myelin. It doesn't unwrap, that electrical tape. It only wraps. Mm-hmm. It doesn't unwrap. And so when I hear someone in AA talking about how, look, I'm still an alcoholic, I just don't drink, but I will always be an alcoholic, to me, I think, well, neurologically, that's exactly right. Yeah. You know, that circuit never disappeared. You still have it, and your success at becoming a new person depends on how well you can construct a new circuit and that kind of overlays the old or exists alongside the old. But that old one is always going to be there, and that's just a fact of being human.
Which, another corollary is, get back, don't start bad habits. Don't do
right.
those things, because you're going to spend the rest of your life, which you hear athletes talk about all the time, and as you said, up at the training center in Colorado Springs, you have to unlearn these things. It's much, much harder. So why not learn it right and correctly, and don't get into bad habits to begin with?
It's a big time saver, tell you what. I mean, yeah, and it's... You can really save a lot of time if you do it right the first time.
Here's an email from a listener named Carol. Said she got into the program a little late, but it's worth talking about her question again. Is it only children that can develop a talent with practice that they love, or can adults do it as well? We haven't really talked about what we know about myelin and learning in later life. I kind of implied at the beginning of the program that you can do it at any age, but is that true?
No, that is true. It's slower. That's the only thing. I mean, you know, we know how quick our kids pick things up, and it's an order of magnitude faster than adults. But are there adults out there? I actually just came from a language center where they were teaching, it was at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where they're teaching Green Berets to speak Farsi and Urdu and these incredibly difficult languages with completely different alphabets. And these guys are pretty darn good at it. It's amazing what they can do in a short few months when being incredibly motivated, incredibly passionate, incredibly obsessed with it. Because they're learning a language that could save their life or their comrade's life over there. It's not casual. And so the essential pathway, no matter what age you are, doesn't change. These Green Berets would have been a lot faster if they would have been 12 years old. They were 25, but it still didn't matter. They could still learn it. It took more effort. It took more sweat, but the essential neural pathway doesn't change. You still can earn myelin. You still can grow fast circuitry. It might take you longer than your, you know, 7-year-old kid, and which would drive you crazy, but the essential truth is that we're all on the same path.
I had an email also that has a link to it, and I'll see if we can't get this link up on it. It mentions something called Super Memo that the writer mentioned. It's an algorithm of a computer program developed by a Polish scientist to improve one's ability to remember what he's learned. or what they've learned. The essence is to learn the optimum point when you should relearn or go back over the material in order to make it stick. It turns out that the point is just when you're about to forget it. The algorithm determines this point. So it's again, something about how long short-term memories and so forth are there, and then you how quickly you can reinforce them is the way I'm thinking about it. But anyway, there's a link to that. I don't know if you'd run into that. It's called Super Memo.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I've seen that guy's work. It's interesting to me because right at that moment where you're about to forget, it's kind of the hardest moment to remember it. And so you're putting yourself on the edge of your ability to remember something, and that we're built to remember things really well, that we re-remember at that key moment. So again, it's a hard thing to do, to push yourself to the edge, but it's got this great payoff.
We only got a couple of minutes left, and another example I think that kind of talks about a good coach and learning how to chunk things was your comment that football coach Tom Martinez said, you quoted him as saying, it's not how fast you can do it, it's how slow you can do it correctly. And that one I have kind of written down for myself.
That's a good one, isn't it? You know, and that really, when he says that, you can almost see the circuitry. You know, you can almost see the circuitry firing. You know, being hasty and being sloppy and quick will get you pretty far, but it won't get you all the way. You need to be able to do it slow. And speed, going really slow, is sort of like putting a magnifying glass on it. You know, if you slowed your golf swing down by a factor of 10, you'd see things that you don't see at full speed. You'd be able to control things and sense things that you didn't see at full speed. There's a great video I've got on the website of Ben Hogan, who would do that. He would practice, the great golfer. He would practice in slow motion. And he's swinging at about, oh, God, it's like it slowed down 500%, you know, really, really slowly. And he would do that as a matter of routine because it showed him where he was correct and where he was incorrect, and it helped him build a better circuit.
I've actually read the same thing about Tiger Woods when he's trying to do something with his swing, that the coaches that he had were kind of frustrated by how slow he kept repeating certain actions over and over.
Is that right?
So some people kind of discover those on their own, or maybe he was watching a lot of Ben Hogan tapes. I don't know. We've only got, let's see, about a minute. I need to ask you, what's next? Where are you going? I'm kind of curious what you're working on. What do you think you're going to be writing about?
Well, I've been... I'm still kind of, this has been, I mean, usually I'd move on to the next book, but this has been kind of the exception in my life, that this book has created a lot of conversation across different groups. You know, in the course of today, we've talked about soldiers and symphony conductors and kids and all adults and everybody. So I'm going to be doing sort of a follow-up to this book that will be called The Little Book of Talent, and it's the idea of to boil some of this stuff down into some hard and fast rules of the ways to practice and equally important, the ways not to practice to build a fast brain. And so that's part of what I'm working on these days.
Well, put me on the mailing list right now.
Done.
I really enjoyed the book. I'd encourage people to get The Talent Code and read it. I think it's applicable to all of us, particularly to those of us who have any interest in children and teaching. Dan, thanks very much. My thanks to Dan Coyle, author of The Talent Code. He's living in the Cleveland area now, but he'll be back this summer, he says, in Homer. So good luck with everything you're doing.
Thanks very much, Dad. It was a real pleasure.
Line One's going to return next week with reproductive and infertility expert Dr. Paul Lynn. Our topic will be newer developments in infertility, and we'll also talk about in vitro fertilization. There's some new things going on there. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program and fielded the phones for us. Thanks for listening, especially those of you who called and emailed. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.